We have a World Series. And if you live in the heartland of America, you're going to hate it. Dodgers, Yankees. We're going to talk about how we got here and think about where we're going. Whew, what a thing. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world excited about Dodgers-Yankees in the World Series. I'm Jake Mintz. That's George Schusterman. And sometimes it's good when Goliath fights Goliath.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to have some version of this conversation like 100 times over the next 5 days. I'm going to keep it pretty simple. This is going to be really cool. We have all been looking at the possibility of this for 10 years. And for the last 10 years, Shohei Ohtani and Juan Soto were not involved. But now they are, and now they will play against each other in the World Series, along with many other famous, wealthy baseball players. But before we preview the World Series, because we have a good amount of time to kind of take a reset and do that, we are recording this on Monday morning. Jake Mintz is in Los Angeles, California, where he will be waiting for the Yankees to arrive. I am still in Ohio, where the New York Yankees punched their ticket to their first World Series since 2009. I was in the building, of course, on Saturday night. We will recap both of those things that we saw, and I will be flying to Los Angeles on Wednesday. But this episode is going to focus on what we have seen more than what we will see, because how did these two Goliaths actually get here? We are going to start at Dodger Stadium, where you were last night, under kind of hilarious circumstances. We can pull the curtain back a little bit because of our coverage plan at Yahoo that has conveniently over the last month not had us go on any airplanes, because I've had the Guardians and Tigers near me, and you of course have had multiple New York teams to cover. Jake, of course, was going to be covering the Yankees if they were nearby. And so there was a chance still that the ALCS was going to go back to New York, in which case I would have also gone to New York for 6 and 7. But as soon as Juan Soto's ball landed beyond the center field fence, and we knew the Yankees were not coming back to New York, they would be going to LA. Jake was on his way to Los Angeles.
I didn't even need the ball to land, dude. I needed the third foul ball or whatever, and yeah, everyone knew. And yes, that's kind of the essence of what happened there. And we will get to that. But yes, I booked a flight at around 11:45 p.m. and then got on it at 7:45 a.m. And that is life in the playoffs. But yes, I'm here in L.A., rolling straight from the airport to Dodger Stadium. Very, the whiplash involved in that was kind of wonky. But I just actually want to start with this. Walking into Dodger Stadium, which you and I have done together a couple times, baseball just feels important there. It does. It does. It has extra heft and weight. And when you're there, it just heightens everything. And as tired as I was and am, that environment did give me a little bit of zip ahead of game 6. Just very quickly on game 5, because we haven't talked since then. Mets kick Jack Flaherty's ass. Pete, one final hurrah, maybe, if he leaves in free agency, hitting a home run at Citi Field. His 106th career home run at Citi Field. Who's second on the list, Jordan?
I don't know.
Lucas Duda with 71. Okay, so
how did he not get a first pitch? I mean, we're going to talk about, yes, Jake did meet this Yoenis Cespedes fella, I believe. Not the first time, but we'll talk about that later. Don't worry. But Lucas Duda, wow. Oh, man, he didn't get the invite.
So the reason I bring that up is Pete has 25 more home runs than anybody else at Citi Field. And I am delighted that he had a moment in game 5. Game 6, though, I wrote this in my story. The Mets ran out of gas, but they really just ran out of pitching. Because game 6 was strikingly simple. Sean Manaea, who had been brilliant for them for the better part of 4 months, 3 months, didn't have it. Didn't have it, and the Mets bullpen was too taxed and too tired and too undermanned To make up for that, Manaea only got six outs. He allowed a two-run double to Tommy Edman in the first. He allowed a two-run homer to Tommy Edman in the third, and then was pulled for Phil Maton. Someone near me said, "Phil Maton, good. That'll stop the bleeding." Maton allowed a two-run home run to Will Smith, and that was really it. Mark Vientos with a two-run blast, I believe, in the fourth inning to claw back his fifth home run of the postseason. I am excited to just think about Vientos this winter and what he could mean and whether he would move to first if Pete leaves, or he really should get a little bit better defensively at third if he's going to stay there. Mets get close in the sixth. This was their real opening with the bases loaded and two outs against Evan Phillips. And Jesse Winker flies out to left. And if you watch the high home of this, or you look at where the outfielders are positioned, Dodgers have this perfectly. Because off the bat, you're like, that's a Winker flare down the line. Like, that's got a real chance to fall. But no, right place, right time, Teoscar catches it. And from there, it was epilogue. Dodgers, you know, give Kodai Senga a swirly. And they that was really hard to watch. And then, hurrah, huzzah, the Los Angeles freaking Dodgers are going to the World Series.
Yeah. And obviously, we'll get to the LCS here. I mean, this was basically the least competitive six-game series you will ever see. I believe it was a top five biggest run differential gap in a single series that we've seen. The Dodgers scored more runs than we've seen in almost any postseason series ever. And as you said, like, the Mets had the pitching that they had kind of assembled that was clicking at the right time is why they got to the postseason to begin with. But once we got here, it was still like, all right, they still got another month to play if they're going to really go on this run. And that's where my skepticism lied. It did not ruin any of how amazing the season was. And I think what you wrote last night really encapsulated that in a really good way. But you combine that with the hitters they were trying to get out, it's a similar thing that we're going to talk about with Cleveland and New York. And Cleveland had a lot more high-end pitching at their disposal, at least in the bullpen, and it didn't matter. Like, you just had too many good hitters that you had to deal with, and it just kind of became too exhausting of a task. And once Manaea went down, it was, I mean, even if Manaea had pitched well, it was probably going to be pretty tough to stay in it. And they just ran out. Yeah.
Like, okay, so the way that the Mets tried to patch this together was compelling because they inverted the pyramid. They sent Edwin Diaz out there in the fourth inning, right? And then they sent Stanek in after him. And there was really no better representation of where the Mets are at right now than watching Ryan Stanek with zero juice left in the juice box just battle through three hitters. And then Mendoza comes to get him. And it's like, I talked to Stanek after the game. He's like, yeah, I had nothing. Like, I just had nothing.
And not just has nothing, right? They send him out there for Will Smith, who he walks, Taylor, who I think is hit by a pitch, who bunts.
There's like an infield.
Yeah. Oh, right. But then it's Ohtani. And it's like, this isn't the guy you want to be dealing with when you're tired. And by the way, he like broke Ohtani's bat. Like, he managed to get weak contact. And then once that drops in, you're like, all right, it's over. Like, this isn't, if Ohtani is dropping balls in with, you know, an 80 mile an hour exit velocity, then that's it. It's a wrap.
The Dodgers bullpen game carousel was not comfortable. There was a lot of traffic. It was not crisp, but it was good enough. And that's all it needed to be last night, a night where the Dodgers offense showed up. Let's zoom out a little bit and talk about this Dodgers team. The beautiful irony is that in a year in which they assembled a comical amount of pitching, turned into a year in which they ran out of somehow seemingly all of that pitching, then became a scenario where they had more pitching than the opponent to take them to the World Series. Now, are they stocked with arms right now? Not really, but they had enough. And that is a testament to the depth of the organization. Like, Ben Kasparis giving, you know, doing an up down yesterday. That's the Dodgers.
Yeah.
Fixing Brent Honeywell or turning Brent Honeywell into a dude who could throw 4 2/3 innings to save the bullpen in game five. Like, that's the Dodgers. There were all these little moments where I was like, that's the freaking Dodgers, man. That's the Dodgers.
But to your point, I mean, they used 7 pitchers and every single pitcher allowed at least 1 hit, which in a bullpen game is honestly pretty rare. You know, normally you have at least 1 or 2 of the guys where it's just like dominant. Like, that's kind of what part of the bullpen game strategy is usually the relievers, if you shuffle through enough of them, one of them will give you, like, even for when Cleveland did it in game 4, like, Hunter Gaddis looked amazing in game 4, right? Because eventually the reliever will just look awesome. But basically nobody, I mean, I guess Diaz was like pretty good. I guess Garrett had like a 1-2-3 inning, but it was pretty messy. And that was kind of this whole series, right? I mean, there was just a lot of runs being scored, and it was cool to see a lot of fun offensive players, you know, kind of eat here. But on the mound, as you mentioned, they did end up with more pitching than the Mets. But I still think that speaks, it does speak to the Dodgers' depth for sure, and their creativity, and Dave Roberts, absolutely. But, you know, it's it wasn't necessarily pretty, but at this point, who cares? You get to the World Series somehow, and for the Dodgers, who have flamed out because, honestly, in some ways, their offense has gone to sleep the last few postseasons. That is obviously not much of a concern, and now they have made it. In a year where everyone was picking against them. Everyone thought the Padres were going to beat them, and the Padres were beating them, and then they weren't. After Tatis hit that home run, that was pretty much the end of the Padres season. We thought it was the end of the Dodgers season, and it turned out to be the end of the Padres season. So sorry to linger on the Padres here, but it is a talking point for sure when you think about how close the Dodgers were to kind of falling there against the team that a lot of people picked them to lose to. But now here they are. And it really is, as you mentioned, just bigger picture. It's just an impressive operation. That is, I think, something we've said about them for a long time.
The Dodgers are both simple and complicated. They have $1 billion hitting 1-2. Okay. $1 billion.
And they have one of the best first basemen of the last half century not playing, who can't walk, and does not have an extra base hit this October, obviously, yeah. Right? Like, and who knows what Freddie Freeman's going to be. But that's the other thing, when you zoom in on this operation, this season, and we'll talk about this with the Yankees in two, I understand the inclination when you hear about Dodgers playing players, and every baseball team does this, whatever, all we've been through, all the adversity, all those things. And there's truth and lies in all of those things, right? We can go through all the things that did absolutely go wrong for the Dodgers this year that they unquestionably did have to overcome. It's not a reason to feel bad for them, right? Because as you just mentioned, they do have $1 billion batting 1-2. But these are real things that happened that they did have to deal with and were the reasons a lot of people, smart people, were writing them off. And I think that is worth acknowledging.
It's like all these things that they have to deal with, right? It's not to feel sorry for them. It's to understand the mentality of the people and the players in the room, because making yourself into the underdog is kind of a must, unless you go full Yankees, in which you're like, we will bully everyone we run into, right?
And the Dodgers, Jazz Chisholm strategy for
bingo
for success, self-confidence, which we support that too.
Yes. But and it felt like that's what the Dodgers getting to the World Series was going to smell like. But it's not really what this was in some ways.
No, and that's
the one other guy. Yeah, the one other guy I want to focus on is Tommy Edman.
Yeah, yeah.
So under the radar deadline ad in that 3-team deal with the White Sox and the Cardinals, the one where Tommy Pham and Eric Fetty end up in St. Louis, and at the time, you and me are dumb asses were like, wow, Cardinals win the deadline. And like, the deadline is silly, obviously, yes. However, Dodgers get Tommy Edman, who has injured for the whole first chunk of the season, who hadn't played a game, who's just a good ball player. Jordan, he's a good freaking ball player. And all the stars on the Dodgers, and Tommy Edman wins NLCS MVP.
Yeah. I mean, it's set up really well, particularly with this last game. I mean, we picked, you know, we did a little round table with MLB.com picking postseason breakout stars, and I picked Edmund on September 24th. And my logic at that point was not that he was going to have 15 RBIs or whatever it was, to be clear, but it was that the reason you get Tommy Edmund is he can do a lot of things for you. And I applied that to postseason hero because it was just like, things will happen and they're going to still need Tommy Edmund. And in this case, they needed him to play shortstop, right? He was playing a lot of center field and then he was playing shortstop. And what he can do is hit lefties a lot better than he can hit righties. And to the point where they felt confident putting him cleanup, right? Which looked goofy, but as you saw, he can crush lefties. And if you can crush Sean Manaea in game six of the NLCS, and you've already driven in however many runs as you have, you will win NLCS MVP. And so for him to be able to plug in and just be their shortstop and be the switch hitter and bring some, you know, some base running and defense and all these things, like, there were just a lot of avenues for him to impact the game. But obviously driving in this many runs is just kind of funny. And to see him, you know, end up, especially in contrast to the ALCS MVP, is wonderfully baseball. And yeah, Tommy M is a great player. And yes, there was risk in acquiring someone who hadn't played this season, but it's not like he was 35, right? This dude is still in his prime. He's been a Gold Glover recently. Like, we've seen him be a good hitter. He's a really good player, and I'm sure we all, you know, underrated that when they got him.
Shohei Ohtani. Good player.
Yeah, quality ball player.
Really swing it.
Couple more hits, couple more runs.
I'm excited
for
you to see him exist here in LA at Dodger Stadium. You know, we have seen Ohtani play in person before, the All-Star game, various points. And the narrative or the idea that people stop what they're doing and watch is true, right? When it's a sold out Dodger Stadium and everyone stands up and like pulls out their phone, it's so cool, dude. It is so cool. I was really kind of thrown by how cool I thought it was in the moment. Like, I was like, this is a different level, not a different level of baseball, but it's just like there's a level of intensity and specialness to it that you're gonna love it. I'm so excited.
I mean, it's one of one for a million reasons we don't have to explain to the people that listen to this podcast. But yeah. I mean, it is really, really something special. Of course, there's a lot to the Ohtani finally getting here that we will discuss in the coming days. But yeah, I mean, just these are just the immediate things we're first kind of thinking about when they you know, win that game last night. And I know you were focused on the Mets. By the way, we are going to say goodbye to the Mets and the Guardians at the end of the show. But I know you were focused on covering the Mets, so you weren't as much around the Dodgers celebration. But yeah, it's just, you see all the things, you see the guys that are playing like the Ohtani and Betts and how good they've been, and Teoscar and Muncy, just incredible players. And then, yeah, when you go to the celebration and you're reminded, you see a shirtless Tyler Glasnow and Clayton Kershaw and all these pitchers that are just really good and not pitching. And you're like, oh, well, yeah, that is part of this story too. So,
all right, let's take a break. When we get back, I guess we'll talk about the New York Yankees also going to the World Series.
Yeah, let's do that. We'll do it.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Jordan Schusterman, my dear friend, before a few days ago, you had never had the privilege or responsibility to wade into the madness of a champagne celebration. And the New York Yankees, so kind, gave you that opportunity by winning game five of the ALCS against the Cleveland Guardians. What a series. As good of a five-game LCS as I can remember. Everything was close, always on a knife's edge, a seesaw back and forth. Give me that five gamer over the NL six gamer every day of the week. You're in the building for this. We don't need to do beat by beat of this last game. We can just zoom ahead, well, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, we can hit the two ones. I mean, we haven't even talked since game four. Game four ended up being way closer than we expected just because of a bunch of ugly. Game four was not pretty, right? Game four was just a version of game two with more runs. We had a Stanton home run in that one. We had a Soto home run in that one too, right? Soto homers early, like three, like maybe 2 minutes into game four. And you're like, all right, this is really not going to be pretty. Guards fight back. They make it close. Ultimately, the Yankees beat Class A again, which goes into game five. And now game five, you're setting up, all right, well, can the Yankees wrap this up? Or will the Guardians somehow send us back to New York again and save their season in improbable fashion, as they already had multiple times? But in this game, the Guardians did go up early. They did. Carlos Rodon was starting for the Yankees. And Carlos honestly looked pretty good. Stuff looked good. And it was just a few bloop hits followed by some fantastic at-bats from Cleveland that managed to get two runs off of Carlos and knock him out in the fifth inning, which, again, was... He didn't feel like the story, but it was like, all right, well, Yankees, are you going to start hitting Tanner Bibee at some point? And for five innings, they were not. Tanner Bibee, for five innings, was... responding to your doubts about him, right? Anyone that watched him was like, this guy, really? He's your ace? He looked fantastic. He had it all working. And then because the Guardians bullpen was so gassed, they were like, all right, Tanner, you look good. You can face the top of the order for a third time. And it almost worked. It almost worked, even though they get a couple base runners early on. In that sixth inning, he gets Aaron Judge to ground into a double play for the first two outs of the sixth. And now he is facing Mr. Giancarlo Stanton with a runner on base. And for the first five pitches, it was like, all right, he knows that we ain't throwing this dude anything to hit. It was clearly the game plan. It's not like they were like, you know what I want to do? I want to hang a slider to the guy with the most raw power in baseball history. No, that was not the plan. And you could tell on that full count pitch, Bo Naylor sets up outside. But as we've seen so many times this postseason, the ball did not go where it was supposed to. And then it went very, very far.
Sure. Don't think about a dolphin.
Oh, darn.
So don't hang this pitch.
Don't hang it.
Oh.
Ooh. I feel bad because I like Tanner Bibee a lot and he was awesome and had a great season. I think he's going to be a great pitcher. But yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, that's not who you make that mistake to. And this ball was, I mean, listen, you've seen this Giancarlo Stanton home run before. It is a singular experience to watch him connect with the baseball. There's just nothing. I guess you saw or heard the Ohtani one that was hit this hard at Citi Field, you know, last week. But this one was really just gone in an instant. And that tied the game. And that really just set it into a state of stuck where both teams and offenses were just like feeling it, feeling the stakes. And we have Cade Smith come in. And even though we were like, okay, who's going to pitch for Cleveland? It was like, nope, same guys. They're coming right back out there because Bibee threw enough that we could stick with our main guys. The Yankees just keep grounding into double plays, including in the 10th, or so we thought. So we go to extra innings. Class A, you know, looked good. Great. He strikes out Stanton. Redemption a little bit too late there. Luke Weaver comes on, clean ninth. We go to the 10th. Here comes Hunter Gaddis. And Austin Wells reaches with a walk after Volpe lines out. And we get a ground ball from Alex Verdugo that we've seen 50 million times to Andrés Giménez, which we've also seen 50 million times. This was going to be another Yankees double play. The team that led baseball in double plays in the regular season and was grounded into them all night appeared to have been grounding into another one. This was a tough one. It's possible Verdugo would have beat it out. But the out was right there at second. Giménez flips it to Rocchio, and Rocchio just fumbles it. And a play that could have been two outs is zero. And you're just immediately like, oh boy, because now you are back to the top of the order. And that's bad news bears for the Guardians of Cleveland.
Rocchio a little sloppy on the defensive side in the series. Yeah.
made an error the night before. Yeah. Game four. I mean, he is a hell of a defender, but he had some rough moments with the glove during this series. Anyway, Gatto strikes out Torres. Great. That should be the end of the inning. It is not. Here comes Juan Soto. And now we engage in a at-bat that has already been watched a billion times. And every time you watch it, you enjoy, appreciate something different. I love how Juan Soto confirmed everything that it looked like. He was like, yes, that is what happened. You could see him saying, like, I got this. Like, I have you. This at-bat will end in my favor. Sorry, Hunter Gaddis. And by that seventh pitch, he had only thrown him changeups and sliders. He finally gives him the fastball. Not a bad pitch, right? This was not a mistake. I mean, I guess the mistake is throwing a fastball at all, but he got it up and out. And doesn't matter when you're facing one of the greatest hitters of all time, even though he doesn't turn 26 until Friday.
He never went off the fastball. That's what's so remarkable about this at bat. Soto is hunting fastball the whole time. And a lot of hitters who would come up in that spot hunting heat would let the soft stuff fool them. Whereas Soto is good enough to just battle it, to just wait it out, to foul it off, to take the pitch. He never comes off the fastball. Even as he's only getting soft stuff, he knows that if the at-bat goes long enough, he will get a heater. And when he gets it, he does not miss it.
But to that point, though, like, these are not the way he was fouling the balls off were telling you that he was on the fastball, because there was the latest pot. Like, it was just these ridiculous swings. And all these pitches are all over the zone. This is not like Gaddis is doing everything you could possibly do to try and to get him to either whiff or, you know, ground or hit a pop fly that's not over the fence. Like, all the game plan was there, and eventually, you know, he relented and this ball was in the air for what felt like 25 minutes. But as you said, like, you kind of knew, like, of course it's going over the fence. Like, the few guys can hit it that hard and backspin it in that way to where it can carry out like that. But it was breathtaking. And I would say it was also kind of a contrast to some of the other massive home runs that we've seen hit in Cleveland over the last couple of weeks, where that has been met with silence. Kerry Carpenter, even the Giancarlo and Judge back-to-back in Game 3, there were a lot of Yankees fans in the building for this Game 5, like more so than 3 and 4. And that makes all the sense in the world. And it was loud. It was loud when this ball went out for Soto. And it was amazing. And Juan Soto, we were lucky enough to be there when he had his first big postseason moment in that wild card game against Milwaukee. That is still one of the loudest things I've ever heard, probably. This certainly wasn't that loud because, you know, the stadium is only 20% Yankees fans instead of, you know, 98% Nationals fans. But it was truly an incredible, incredible scene. And Soto, who had, not that he hadn't already had some moments this postseason, but he is a special, special, special person and player.
Always in control. He's just always in control of an at-bat. The at-bat belongs to him. And if you're a pitcher, you're just a participant. You are a foil. You are there for him to play with as a toy, right? And this at-bat, when he is that locked in, the outcome surely is inevitable. Bottom of the 10th, Luke Weaver gets out of it.
Yeah. Which, by the way, I was just going to say, like, this is the other story of this game is Mark Leiter Jr., who was not on the roster, Tim Hill, Jake Cousins looked incredible, and then Weaver for two. The Yankees bullpen was touched up a bit here in this series. Jeter said something on the postgame show last night where he was like, yeah, this Yankees bullpen hasn't been hit yet. I was like, well, you've clearly been busy watching the Dodgers and Mets because Clay Holmes having a tough time. And, you know, they're running on fumes also, but they had just enough starting pitching to put them in a better position to put these guys in the game late and get the job done. And that's the thing, is the contrast between the offensive star power of this team. And this is sort of similar with the Dodgers. But with the Yankees, it's more by design. You know, they're not missing that many guys. I know Nestor maybe is going to come back for this World Series, but this is the team, man. They've assembled this bullpen. You've sung the praises of Matt Blake, and it's a pretty hilarious group of castoffs when you combine that with these star hitters. It makes for a very funny post-game celebration. I tweeted a picture of Juan Soto with the bullpen. It was just a great, you know, combination of human beings. It's Juan Soto and Tim Hill were just like going ham together, which is like, what is that? That's random. And then you're like, oh yeah, Padres. That took me a second. But yeah, so all those, and to me, I would say, if we circle back to your first question, my first experience being in there for the champagne and the cigars and everything, I mean, it's just a funny thing. You just see funny things left and right, because it's just an objectively hilarious human social dynamic. But it's those combinations of people, and you just see all the people that are meshing together, and you think about that over the course of baseball season in general. But when you're seeing them hammered and letting loose, right, and stop and not being guarded and not just letting it all hang out, like, that is hilarious and great. And you just think about what it means to all the different players for them to be there. Some of them, very few have done this before, right? Very sure. It's not like the Dodgers, where half this team was there in 2020, or at least close to half this team. It's actually not Verdugo. I was thinking it was Verdugo, but he didn't play when he was with the Dodgers in 18, he was not on that team, or with Boston, right? Obviously, he was not there at that point either. So, yeah, it's Gerrit Cole, it's Juan Soto, and it's Anthony Rizzo. Anthony Rizzo knows a little something about celebrating in Cleveland. He was certainly enjoying himself as well. But yeah, this Yankees team, this is the first time I had seen him all season, which is kind of a strange situation for me. But it was really cool, and I'm pretty excited to see what happens next for them.
Aaron Judge,
yeah.
Aaron Judge, as a regular season Yankee, has done the thing. Like, he has accomplished a sufficient resume to be considered a legend in pinstripes, but in this place for this franchise, that matters less. It matters less than winning the whole thing, because they did it 27 times. And I think, like, if Aaron Judge never wins a World Series, that will be one of the first three sentences that is said about him, because he's a Yankee, right? No one ever is like, man, Todd Helton never won a World Series, right? Barry Bonds never won a World Series. That might be sentence like eight, right? But Aaron Judge never won a World Series. Like, that is what people will remember, for fair or not. And so I think what I took away watching the end of this game and celebration is a little sense of miniature relief for Judge. Now, obviously, it's not the same as if they win the World Series. That catharsis will be just an unstoppable waterfall. But you could see a little of it, right? You could see a little of it, because the expectations of what it means to be Aaron Judge, to lead the franchise where it is win it all or nothing, in a sport where winning it all is so hard and so random. And to know that you are judged by strangers for something mostly out of your control. Yes, you can hit 62 or whatever, right? You could come up clutch, and you could create a culture, and you can lead a clubhouse, and you can do all those things. But at the end of the day, still a game of roulette. Just appreciating him as this leader, as the captain of this Yankees group. And no neutrals will ever root for the Yankees, obviously, right? But I think one should be able to appreciate the life that Aaron Judge has lived, and appreciate that he is now able to experience what he has gotten to experience by getting to the World Series.
Yeah, I agree with all that. The other thing I would add, and I would say that was, I think that was clear, you know, he is so... stoic's not the right word, but he really is just like, keeps it so the same all the time, because that's part of the job for him in particular. But it was clear that he understood, and this is the other point I just want to make about him, before we take a break, is just like, when you think about how his career started and 2017 as a rookie, and after that season, how close they get with Houston, regardless of, I'm not relitigating why they lost, whatever, but that, to get that close and then to trade for Giancarlo a month later, you know, at that point, you're like, all right, well, this is, now it's just a matter of time, you know? And for the number of times that they've lost since then, sometimes close to the World Series, sometimes 2023, where it is just a complete catastrophe. Listen, it's not 20 years of torture, right? It's but when you think about also how close he did get to free agency, not that we ever really thought he was going to leave, but that was part of that conversation too, is that he had earned that much that they wanted to keep him when he hadn't yet, you know, won or even come that close, hadn't even been to the World Series yet. I think that speaks to him. I think that speaks to what they think of him, and now it will be very cool to see him there. But ultimately, the reason they're going is because they traded for Juan Soto. Because Giancarlo Stanton is on a heater of a lifetime, as well as some other obviously important contributions up and down the lineup. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we will say goodbye to the Mets and the Guardians and give you our earliest thoughts at the combination between the Dodgers and the Yankees in the World Series. We'll be right back.
And welcome back, Baseball Barbercast. Let's do Dodgers-Yankees first, and then we'll say goodbye to the Mets and the Guardians. The obvious thing is wow. Wow, wow, wow. These are the two biggest teams. They are very far apart in the two biggest cities. They have the two best players on them in Aaron Judge and Shohei Ohtani. It will be a spectacle. It will cross over. It will have relevance. People in your lives who don't typically care about baseball, knowing that you, my dear listener, are the baseball caring person in a friendship, they will ask you about Shohei Ohtani and Aaron Judge. They will do that. And you will say, yes, yes, this is worth watching.
Yeah. And I think that it is so much to process the fact that we have been looking at these two teams basically since we've been doing this, right, which is about 10 years. I mean, no two teams have more regular season wins over the last 10 years than these two. Certainly since 09, right? 09, when the Yankees win the World Series, the Dodgers were also the one seed that year. They didn't make it. It had a bit of a transition period after that for the Dodgers, but since 2013, you know, since we've been talking into microphones together, this is it. These are the two teams, and we figured we would get it at some point. But, you know, I think the reaction to it, you say, oh, Dodgers, Yankees, you know, if this had happened last year, there would be some excitement to some degree. And I know the Yankees were nowhere close to the postseason last year. But I think thinking about it, like the Ohtani sort of thing is just so, it adds such a just tremendous level to it. Because if we were watching the same Dodger team that we had already seen multiple times do this, or the same Yankee team that we had kind of already seen for multiple years. But there are new characters here, new characters who are two of the most relevant, and also ultimately two of the most likable, you know? And so I think for me, that really helps make this something that was already going to be spectacular because of the markets and the teams and the brands involved. But the other funny part is, you know, when they say, like, this is one of baseball's most historic rivalries, no two teams have met in the World Series more, I'm like, okay, yeah, but if you're younger than 40 years old, it doesn't mean anything to you. Like, this isn't, again, 1981's a long time ago. And yes, we've been talking about these two teams for the last 10 years all the time. And I know longer than that, but I'm just thinking about us, but not together. You know, sure, they play in the regular season more often now because of the interleague, but these are not two teams we actually think about together, because it hasn't actually ever happened in this sense. And so while it would be nice if Tyler Glasnow was also healthy and Kershaw was also a part of this, and somebody's like, sure, you know, there's some missing elements, but this is about as good as it gets. I mean, you can't really squeeze in at more stars into one World Series than this. And I can't even, as far as just like the historic spectacle of it, to me, we haven't seen anything like this since the Cubs, certainly, you know, in terms of just how fortunate I already feel that I'm going to be able to see this. It's no, I haven't felt this way since the Cubs, you know, in Cleveland, which we were lucky to be there in Wrigley in 2016. Because other than that, of course, we've been to some World Series since then, and we've seen some great games and seen some cool stuff. But the heft of this is really something to behold.
And not to disrespect the 2023 Rangers, who did the thing, and Rangers fans should hold on to that forever. Going from Arizona, Texas to New York, LA is going to feel grander.
Yeah.
It's going to have more punch. It's going to have more zest. It just is.
Yeah. And to that point, you know, Jeff Passan tweeted, just like as many people after we get that, he said something along the lines of like, you know, you have these two, the biggest payrolls in these two big cities, a lot of teams that people don't like, and that's going to turn a lot of people off. Maybe. I can't really relate to that. And I know we work in the sports, so we have this warped view, and I know it's our job to not care. Like, but man, like, you don't want to watch these players, man. Like, I don't really think this is going to turn people off. Like, I understand that there are a lot of fans that don't want to see the Yankees win, don't want to see the Dodgers win. I get that. I can understand not wanting to watch this if you like baseball in to any level. I'm not telling people how to be a fan. If you are a Mets fan or a Red Sox fan who says, I refute Padres and say, this is despicable, I will not watch that. I'm not telling you you're wrong. I just, that's the part that, like, I think we're almost overthinking it to be like, this is going to turn people off. It's like, no. These are the best players in the world. And I think people are going to enjoy watching Shohei Ohtani and Juan Soto if you just ended at that, not to mention all the other, you know, future Hall of Famers we have involved.
So we'll do a full preview later this week. Jordan is headed out to LA on Wednesday, where we will have tons of fun World Series coverage at Yahoo Sports. Let's say goodbye to the Mets and the Guardians, who had a similar energy in some ways, but, you know, distinct all their own. And I'll begin with the Mets, who I wrote about yesterday. This is a team we will remember for a long time. A long time. Part of that is because of how poorly they started and how well they finished. Part of that is because they had really three iconic memories. The Lindor homer in the weird Atlanta, not a playoff game. The Pete homer in Milwaukee and the Lindor grand slam against the Phillies. Those are three swings that are really, really big. And then, of course, they had the shticks. They had the gimmicks. The OMG, the OMG sign, the pumpkin, Grimace, even bringing the Temptations in to sing My Girl before game five of the NLCS. Like, they had bits, man. This team had bits. And this is kind of what I wrote about. Like, some of those bits will have to die. They will have to go. You can't do the OMG bit if Jose Iglesias is on the Brewers or whatever. It just doesn't work, right? And so while the Mets outlook is better than it was a year ago, there's still a lot of uncertainty, a lot of players hitting free agency. I believe they have $180-something million coming off the books. 3/5 of the rotation is going to be on the market for free agency. Alonso's a free agent. Winker, Bader, J.D. Martinez. They're going to have to fill a lot of holes here. And even though I feel good about this core, Vientos, Lindor, whatever, it will never be this again. And that is both beautiful and sad that this, and that's true at the end of any season, right? Like, the collection of any team of these particular players, it's all 1 year and gone. The energy is never replicable. What the Mets did this year feels really difficult to copy and paste moving forward from, like, the energy of it. And they'll try, and there'll be elements, sure. But the idea that the highest payroll in baseball became a lovable Cinderella underdog in and of itself was just so wonky. And what I was left with at the end, walking around this clubhouse, was the experience of playing meaningful baseball, that meaningful baseball, for six straight weeks was both clearly exhausting for these gentlemen and yet the whole point of it all. Because while teams are chasing a ring, guys are also chasing the feeling of playing games that have oomph to them. And the Mets did that. They made it matter for a period of time after it felt like they were cooked. And I will remember this team for a long, long time. And I hope everyone does too.
Yeah, I think that the two kind of cliches of end of a season that resonate with me, one you just touched on, but both of them you just kind of touched on. One is, which I'll mention with Cleveland, right, you can't, every team every year is different, and the collection of people is always different, the combination of people, particularly in baseball, when you just have so much turnover on a year-to-year basis, and every individual person, it's not like, I mean, yeah, of course we know Francisco Lindor is going to be there again next year, and that's very important, but the chemistry is always going to be different, sometimes positive, sometimes negatively. And it's not always just because of the best players. It's just a lot of people involved that influence that, right? And I'll talk about that with Hedges with Cleveland. But the point is that you never know what it's going to be. And then the other thing is, as we get to Cleveland, and this is a little bit different with New York because of the direction of their team and the ownership, we very much expect them to be there. But especially with a younger team like Cleveland, once you get there, AJ Hinch talked about this a lot with Detroit. Once you get there, that's all you want ever. And you don't really understand it until you actually have played in it. Even if, of course, all the players that haven't been to the playoffs yet want to get to the playoffs. But it doesn't guarantee anything, just because they have that extra motivation and drive because they have tasted it before doesn't guarantee them that they'll be there again the next season. But that is a very real thing that you can tell when the season does end. It is very much a driving thing and something that, you know, pushes a lot of these people to understand what it means to be playing at this time of the year. As for Cleveland, obviously a very different kind of story. You know, with the Mets, they were so bad early in the season, and they kind of, after June, really put it together. Cleveland, a bit of a different story, right? Cleveland just jumps out of the gate, and it's like, oh my God, this team is great. Like, how is this happening? They had one of baseball's best records for the first 2 months. You think about just the bigger picture of this was, talk about transition year. I mean, you hire Stephen Vogt. He was playing 2 years ago. You say goodbye to Tito Francona after last year was such a disappointing season, and you did nothing in the offseason to give reasons to be like, all right, it's going to get better. And they have all these injuries. The pitching staff is just a mess, and Bieber goes down, and McKenzie is hurt and disappointing, and none of the starting rotation goes to plan, or the bullpen for that matter, right? They lose Stefan and Karinchak and Henches and all these guys that get hurt. And it just doesn't matter because that bullpen is just so, 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 so good. And Clase is so, so good in the regular season, as we know. And it just, you know, another Ramirez season and Kwan and Naylor, you know, have these all-star first halves. And for them to be that good and to stay on top of what turned out to be such a good division is not a small feat at all. And I think when we talk about organizations, and you talk about what it means to be a consistent winner, you know who has the third most wins over the last 10 years in Major League Baseball? It's the Cleveland Guardians. And that is an amazing accomplishment and a reminder of the infrastructure that they have in place. It's not necessarily a reason to excuse being 24th in payroll. And I think as we look ahead, I mean, if now is the time, maybe it's not you're going to go spend like the Dodgers or Yankees, but man, look at what the Royals just did last year and look at what it did for them, right? If the Guardians had signed Seth Lugo and Michael Wacha, we might be talking about them in the World Series, you know? And so you could play that what if game for a million parts of any season, but what they did this year and me getting to be, you know, up close for this and know how strong a lot of the core is, even if the raw talent, as we saw in this series, was not up to the level of the New York Yankees. That's the case for most teams. But they were one of the last four teams here, and that was not an accident. And I think that speaks to Vogt, that speaks to their coaching staff, speaks to their player development, it speaks to their front office. They're doing so many things right, and I'm super impressed with them, and I'm excited to see what they do from here. But this needs to be, again, longest World Series drought in the league, right? 76 years is a long time. And so if you're, and this is an incredible sports town. So if they're not motivated to push after this winter, and to some degree, that would obviously be super disappointing, but still a lot to be proud of. And knowing that I will be here for the long haul, I'm excited to see what is to come for this franchise.
I mean, you're like the longest tenured Cleveland Guardian.
Yeah. I mean, I've been an Ohio person for a lot longer than some of these other people, just me and Jose. But not as long as Chris Antonetti and Mike Chernoff, who have been at this for quite a long time in this organization. And to get this close, man, again, is tough, because it doesn't look like it's going to get that much easier in the AL Central. But they are a fun team to watch, and I'm excited to see what happens next.
All right, before we say goodbye, let's talk about Yoenis Cespedes.
All right, so we knew that this was happening. However, because of our jobs and the games we were covering, this was not something we were like talking about in the days leading up to it. Quite the opposite, actually. So yes, they announced that Cespedes was throwing out the first pitch, or sorry, catching the first pitch in game five. Although we should point out, at the time, we didn't know that game five would necessarily, I think they announced it before we even knew there was going to be a game five. But anyway, once the Mets win, we know we're going to have a game two. We know we're going to have a game five. But as we mentioned, like, you were both just running around covering these games, and especially like, you're not thinking about this. And then day of, right? You called me and you're like, hey, this is happening today, right? Like, I got to probably get there, right? Well, yeah, you probably should. So to give people context, not like the whole context for him being the person we named everything after, we have met him before. So we can,
once.
I don't know if we've told that story, but we had it set up through some very kind people that, again, sort of hilarious timing. What, about a month before he was traded to the Mets, right?
He was on the Tigers.
To the Mets. Yep.
He was on the Tigers. We were in Los Angeles on a trip at Angel Stadium. They were playing the Tigers. We had it set up. We talked to him for like 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. He kind of got the bit.
Yeah, I mean, again, this was think about how confused he must have been, but very gracious, very kind. We asked him about the barbecue. He said, yeah, that was my birthday. And it was his birthday the other day when he was catching the first pitch. How fitting. And Jake Mintz, you were there and you got to reconnect with Yo. And how was it?
Just a couple old friends chopping it up. You know, I wished him a happy birthday.
Yeah, it's good.
And he remembered the account, which was a delight. He was unavoidable because he was wearing a white Mets jersey, obviously with his name on it, and just like electric white jeans. He looked like the Shabbos queen, an angel in white. And he's just floating around the infield track, and then goes down into like the area outside the dugout, like between the dugout and the clubhouse. And I saw him, I was like, I'm just going to go over there. So I just walked over. He was taking pictures with the security guys down in the tunnel. I was just like, hey, yo, you don't remember me? This is me. I showed him the account and he looked at me. He goes, I remember you. You're bigger now. And I said, you look the same. And so we talked for a couple minutes.
It is funny. Look at the picture that we took in 2015. It's like, those are children.
I was 40 pounds lighter.
Yeah.
Yoenis, on the other hand, identical. Looks just like, looks great. Turned 39. And I asked him, how's the family? Everyone good? And he goes, well, you know, my son is in the Dominican trying to get signed. That's
wow.
Right.
Wow.
Yo okay. Jr.
Yes.
Class of 2028 high school, I believe.
Oh my God. 2028.
Yo Jr., the family barbecue is down there playing some third base.
Okay.
Big right-handed slugger.
Yeah. All right.
And we've seen videos of Yo Jr. before, because Yoenis, who now works for a bat company, like sponsors this travel ball team.
He's one of the owners of Chandler Bats. Like, he is Chandler Bats, which, by the way, you know who swings Chandler Bats? Aaron Judge and Shohei Ohtani. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
But Cespedes, that's what he does now. He's just like involved in that. And he coaches this travel ball team, or we've seen him coach or at least be around this travel ball team a lot. And yeah, I'd kind of lost track of how old Yo Jr. was at this point, but that's amazing. And this is something you sometimes see, players who are born in or have, you know, Latin heritage will go down, who maybe live in Florida regularly, will go down to DR or Venezuela to sign, you know, internationally. Again, long way to go here, but that is a path that sometimes players can take. So that is incredible. Yes, I have wondered about Yo Jr. for a while for obvious reasons, and I appreciate that update.
But, you know, we're old now.
Yeah, I mean, like, listen, the whole thing doesn't matter, man. It doesn't. But I think what we're grateful for is all of this was an accident, right? The plan was not, all right, we'll name it after this guy and then we'll be doing this for 10 years. So when you consider that, I think we can just be grateful for a lot of reasons. But if focus on him, it's that him and his people have been aware that we have, you know, unintentionally fallen into, you know, using him as this kind of hilarious representation of our love for the sport. And they've been like, yeah, that's cool. And for that, I am obviously forever grateful. And I hope that we will hang out with him again in 10 years. and I wish the best for him, and I hope that he's happy and enjoying what was never, by the way, ever officially I'm retiring. That never happened. But that's Yo, right? Like, if he showed up and tried to make a team in 2 years, as this has been the theme of his career, it's nothing really surprises us. So it was cool to see him back there, and I know he's obviously beloved in Queens.
We will be there, Jordan, for Yo's debut, and we will be there with the entire barbecue family.
Yo Jr.
Not Yo. Yes. Yo Jr. Yeah. That's it. Done.
That's it. Thank you all for listening. A lot more to talk about. Believe it or not, there are, man, it's almost like the narrative machine bit was just waiting for Dodgers Yankees World Series. So Jake will rev that up for Wednesday's episode. But until then, we're going to get some sleep. And I will fly to Los Angeles on Wednesday. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, producer Andrew Hartz. So much more to come this week. World Series starts on Friday. We'll talk to you all very soon. Thank you all for listening. BaseballBarbercast@gmail.com. Keep sending us funny emails. We appreciate it. Talk soon. Bye.